Doctor Who, Short Trips. The World Beyond the Trees by Jonathan Barnes. Read by Nicola Walker. Hi, Dad. This is me. This is Liv. Of course, I know you'll never get to hear this, but you see, something's happened. Something which made me think of you. So much has changed since we last spoke, too hurriedly and too late. There's so much I could tell you, if only that were possible. Nyxis 7, the Lorelei, the horizon at the end of the universe. But none of that's important, at least it's not important now. You'd find this all far too vague, I know. I can imagine you peering at me over the rims of those glasses I was never sure you really needed and saying encouragingly, "Come on, Liv, deep breaths, arrange your thoughts logically, place them in the best order." So, okay, that's what I'm going to do. Just the way you taught me. I'm going to tell you exactly what happened, sensibly and calmly, and with a level head. First, some necessary context. I'm living in the past, and not metaphorically. Dad, there's a race far more advanced than humanity which mastered time travel long ago, and I've come to know one of them. We're not friends, exactly, or anything else. We're close associates. He's the kind of man, though to be accurate, he's not really a man at all, who draws other people into orbit around him. So that's what I've become. A sort of satellite. One, at present, of two. His name? I don't even know for sure. He calls himself the Doctor. I'm in London, in England, in the 8th decade of the 20th century. At first, as you can imagine, this was startlingly odd. Not just the primitivism of it, not just the being surrounded on all sides by history, not even its smells, tobacco and spilt beer, spoilt food and unwashed bodies. No, odder than all of that was how unexpectedly free it made me feel. The almost joyful sense of liberation. We've been here months now, and I'm getting used to it. Quicker than I would have thought possible. Getting accustomed to this ancient place and its everyday savagery. Centuries before my birth, I felt more at home than I have anywhere in years. We're living in a place called Baker Street, in a house that's comfortable and warm and which, compared to the thin, shining walls of spaceships, feels real. Things here are solid. They have heft. For all that they're cracking and flaking and fraying at the edges, everything seems somehow earned. The Doctor's not around at the moment, so he's left us this house to while away our days. Me and his other friend, the one I've mentioned, drawn from a time even further back than this. An Irish girl with the most beguiling dark eyes. We've little enough in common, almost nothing, I think, except for the Doctor himself. But we've got on well. We've each learned from the other, and we've become almost close. She'd like to be closer still, I know, as she's got a big and open heart, but you remember how I am. I haven't let her in as much as I could have. You might be disappointed, I suppose, to hear it, but I've come to believe that there's a certain safety in keeping people at arm's length. But with her, it's been different. She doesn't feature much in what I'm going to tell you now, but I want you to know, I'm not sure why, that she's been kind to me and that she's done her best to draw me out. But as I say, this story isn't about her. It's about me and a girl called Lilla. And in an odd way, it's about you too. I woke up a few days ago from a dream of unusual clarity. It was vivid and precise and almost not much like a dream at all. More like something delivered from very far away, directly to my imagination. The Doctor was in it, and he was standing in a rose garden, a very placid and beautiful place, more like a painting come to life than a real location. The doctor's a handsome man with close-cropped hair, and I suppose there are plenty who'd think he was dashing, even romantic. But not me. He's changed, you see, since I've known him, the first time we met. He's altered so much, and I know he's so much more complicated than he seems. Liv. That was how it began, with the doctor leaning forward in his garden, almost as if he were addressing a camera and speaking in his soft, old-fashioned voice, my name. Liv, we don't have long, and I need you to listen. Now, I've made some arrangements of my own, I've crossed my own timeline, and I've broken all the rules, but I still need your help. Yours, Liv. Now, you have to concentrate. In my dream, I couldn't speak. I couldn't answer back, but this was what I was thinking. Yes, Doctor, what is it?
What's the emergency now?
The Damascus Project, Liv. He seemed insistent. At the time, I didn't understand the reference. Oh, you'll be seeing Damascus soon. But to do that, you'll need to find the fourth tree, and you'll need to knock four times. You understand me? Damascus. Fourth tree, four knocks. Still, no words would come, although I tried my best. The doctor has a way of looking at you, searchingly, trustingly, when he's asking for your help. I wanted to get him to tell me more, to explain himself completely, but then there was something in the sky, a flock of dark birds who all of a sudden swooped, pouring madly into the garden, and then he was flinging his hands up over his face, and he was covering his eyes, and he was trying to protect himself, and there was everywhere black plumage and black feathers, and the doctor calling out in shock. Then the dream was over, and I was back in my bed in Baker Street, sweating and anxious, with daylight in my eyes, but with my head still full of the garden, with the birds of ill omen, and with the voice of the Time Lord. The first thing I noticed when I came back to full consciousness was how very quiet everything was. Baker Street in the 1970s is usually a noisy place, traffic, pedestrians, tourists, the roar of the city, but on that morning there was almost nothing. A faint and distant hum, maybe, but nothing else. Aware that something had shifted, I got out of bed, wrapped myself in my dressing gown, and sleepily perplexed, took myself downstairs for breakfast. Do you remember, Dad, telling me about the rule of three? You said once that while two things in a row feel like coincidence, and four can seem excessive, three single connected incidents feel designed and meant. And that was how it was yesterday. First the dream, then the strange, pervasive noiselessness, and after that, what I saw at the breakfast table, all confirmed to me that the hours ahead were going to be anything but routine. There was Molly, my flatmate, I suppose would be the word, slumped beside a bowl of that bland corn-based foodstuff which is eaten in this epoch at this time of day, staring dead ahead, heavy-lidded and vacant. Now, this is nothing at all like Molly. Generally, she's what people here call the life and soul. Good morning, I said, but got no answer. She just sat there, leaning, blank behind the eyes. Molly, I said. Molly, is everything okay? By now, a spectrum of possibilities had occurred to me, from an atypically determined hangover to something far more seriously awry. Molly, I tried one more time. Molly, can you hear me? There was no response, nothing, not even a glimpse of the woman I was starting to know. Swiftly, unsentimentally, I examined her. There was nothing obviously wrong or even close to it. It was as if she was simply in the grip of some extreme sort of lassitude, as if she was just fantastically bored. I even shook her, gently, but enough to have woken her if she'd fallen into a trance. No. This was something different, beyond my experience. And all the while, from outside, came the same sort of nothing as before, near silence, punctuated by birdsong. I didn't panic, but I thought things through, logically and carefully. You'd have been pleased. You'd have been proud. Communications in this phase of human development are highly unreliable. All the same, you have to use the tools that are available, and so I switched on what they call a wireless, one of their chief means of disseminating information on a national scale. All I heard on every frequency was static, nothing but hiss and crackle. The television, once it had sullenly warmed up, was no better. Nothing on every one of the few channels but electronic snow. I turned off the machine, made sure Molly was comfortable, and I went outside to investigate, feeling oddly not afraid or even particularly nervous, but filled instead with a kind of wonder. As I left the house and walked out into Baker Street, I came to see that some great wave of drowsiness had washed over the city. Cars had stopped, and their engines idled while their drivers gazed dozily through windscreens. Pedestrians had sat themselves down by the side of the street like they'd been overcome by fatigue. Traffic lights flicked through their cycle over and over again, but to no purpose, as fossil fuel burned pointlessly in tanks. Shops and cafes were open for business, but there was nobody inside who'd serve you. The cashiers and the waitresses were either napping on the floor behind the tills or else they were looking dully at their stock, in no mood even to raise their eyes to look at you. I could have walked into any one of them. I could have helped myself to anything I chose, clothes, food, even the old-fashioned paper books they still read here, and no one would have been any the wiser. Actually, that's not quite true. They would have noticed, I'm fairly sure of that, but somehow they'd have just let me do it. They wouldn't have cared, and they wouldn't have lifted a finger to stop me. All the people, all along Baker Street, were like Molly, or even worse. Everywhere there was stillness and incuriosity. I walked on. I left the house and the street behind me, and I walked on into London. I can't describe, at least not to my satisfaction, the sheer strangeness of the experience. It was as though all the city was slumbering and that I alone was walking through its dreams. For so long, my life's been filled up with duty and sacrifice and, this isn't self-pity, I promise, with suffering too, that there was something kind of wonderful in walking on my own through the slumbering city. There are plenty who'd have just found it lonely. Molly, for one. But not me. You know, I was always quite content by myself, always happy in my own company. As I went from Baker Street into Marylebone, I realised that while humanity seemed to have fallen into this drowsiness, the animal kingdom was totally unaffected. As I strolled first towards Great Portland Street and then circuitously into the green space of Regent's Park, I noticed creatures much bolder than usual on the grass and the walkways. Squirrels, sleek urban foxes, a hedgehog, a couple of stray cats, an Irish wolfhound, its lead still attached, loping happily along. Two Pekingese ran with delight around their dozing owners. There was even a badger glimpsed for an instant in the undergrowth. It was as if mankind had receded into the background, and that all the other species, all the other miracles who inhabit this planet, had come out to play. There was a time in the park when it felt, don't laugh, not like a dream at all anymore, but more like a fairy tale. One in which I was the princess. I was thinking this thought when I saw ahead of me a young woman. She was on her feet and walking fast, not like the others at all, but upright and striding and moving quickly as if she were looking for something. I suppose a part of me felt dismay at this, the realisation that I wasn't quite as alone as I'd thought. But then another emotion took hold. Curiosity. The need to know. For a minute or so, I just followed. I didn't call out. I didn't draw attention to myself. I moved off the tarmac and onto the grass, the better for the earth to mask my footfalls. For a while, I watched her. She was moving with obvious purpose. There was an intensity to her, not panic necessarily, or even fear, but I thought there was something urging her on, some impetus or energy, something she was only just keeping under control. I don't know what gave me away in the end. Maybe my steps were louder than I thought. Maybe she caught sight of my shadow on the ground. Maybe it was just that sense you get, unscientific but true, when you know you're being watched. Whatever it was, the woman turned quite suddenly and paused at the sight of me. Her eyes grew very wide, but she didn't speak. Instead, she only turned on her heel and ran as fast as she could away from me. I've done a lot of running lately, Dad. I think you'd be proud. Being with the doctor, it's practically a way of life. It's what he does, and by extension, it's what we do too. We sprint down corridors and we race along gantries. We don't run away from danger, but towards it. But that pursuit in the park felt different. We were both fast, but somehow it didn't seem that way. It was more like we were underwater, surrounded by some inhibiting substance. I didn't give up. I ran her to ground by the entrance of what appeared to be some sort of outside auditorium. A theatre, I think. Such places are still popular in this time. The girl tripped and fell and went sprawling on the patch of grass outside the ticket office. She was young, not more than 20, dark-haired with clear green eyes. As I reached her side, she looked up at me and scrambled to her feet. She seemed scared, flustered and afraid. I could tell at a glance that she was no threat of any kind. I smiled and held out my hand. "Hello," I said, careful of her skittishness, trying not to startle her. "I'm Liv, Livchenka." She blinked fiercely and I could see it spread across her face. The decision not to flee. "I'm Lilla." Very gingerly, she shook my hand. I was calm but insistent, kindly but firm, all part of a medtech's bedside manner. "So it's alien, isn't it? I mean, whatever's caused all this." She gave me a wistful smile. "Yeah, it's alien." She paused. "Alien like me." "You're not human," I asked. "Only in appearance. I'm from a planet called Augustine's Mercy, but I was very small when we came here. I can hardly remember my home. And you? Where are you from?" How odd it seems now, the two of us exchanging dinner party pleasantries in a world asleep and dreaming. "Oh, I am human," I said, "but I was born on Kaldor in the future." The slight absurdity of the remark hung between us. The girl grinned and she seemed all of a sudden even younger than before, barely more than a child. "Well, I'm pleased to meet you, Livchenka, from the future." She seemed momentarily pensive. "I suppose it's that which has kept you safe. Perhaps the human template has shifted by your time. But strictly speaking, no human being ought to be immune from what my dad called the listlessness field."
"So that's what's caused all this?"
"Yeah. But who did it and why?" The girl shrugged. "I can answer all your questions, but we'd better keep moving. The milieu will be looking for me, so the sooner I reach the Damascus Project, the better." "Did you say Damascus?" I asked. "Yeah. Does that mean something to you?"
"Something," I said.
"Something that was told me in a dream."
I was about to say more when, from somewhere nearer than was altogether comfortable, we heard a kind of bass, electronic, rippling, thrumming sound, deep, like artificial thunder. We looked at each other. Lilla seemed younger now than ever. I said, "That was some sort of transportation beam."
"So the milieu have found me again."
"Who are this milieu?" I said, speaking urgently. "Are they the ones who caused this? And what do they want with you?"
Sweat glistened on Lilla's forehead. "Liv, I can trust you, can't I? I mean, yeah, we've only just met, but somehow I can just tell. You're one of the good ones."
"Of course," I said. "Of course you can trust me." She was looking around her, starting to panic.
"Then let me show you. Let me show you it all." And she touched me. She touched me on my forehead, in the space between my eyebrows, and just as she'd promised, I saw it all. A telepathic gift given freely to a stranger. Incredibly,
A whole life in seconds, distilled to fragments and glimpses. Her home, a kind of farmstead on a verdant green planet, with two suns in the sky, filled with fauna and odd, sinuous creatures. Her father, a hero to his daughter, a generous, open-hearted man. I see the relationship between father and daughter, their sweet dependence. No mother. And the man's work, his laboratory at the heart of their home. The listlessness device itself, no bigger than a cricket ball, emitting the field whose effects I had already witnessed. Then action and reaction. Some political shift on Augustine's mercy, some darker government in power. Father and daughter fleeing to Earth, arriving with almost nothing save for his expertise and her childish smile. And the machine, stowed in a rucksack, but capable at a stroke of stopping whole cities. I see their landing in the east of England and the destruction of their fragile craft. I see the way in which they hide themselves in the general population. I see Lilla go to school and her father toil in a library doing nothing at all to attract attention. I see the authorities learning of his presence here. And I see the theft of his new work, his latest masterpiece, by human beings whom he ought never to have trusted. After that, I see him grow ill, too young. I see him become first confused and vague, then belligerent, then descend into oblivion. A terrible lingering death, one which took away his dignity in dreadful increments. I watch Lilla tend to him, and I see him slip away in her arms, him no longer knowing who she is or why she looks after him with such inexhaustible affection. And then much later, I see alien ships in the sky, come to Earth to search for the device, discerning in the listlessness field a weapon which could change everything. And I see the orphan hear the news, realize the current of events, and make the only choice she can. Her fingers slipped away from my skin. The kaleidoscope of pictures stopped, and I was back in the present again. "It was you," I said. "You activated the listlessness field. You've caused all this." Lilla looked almost embarrassed. "Yeah, I mean, I didn't want to, and I don't think Dad would have exactly approved, but the milieu are ruthless, selfish creatures. They won't stop till they get what they want. I needed a distraction to give me time, if I can, to get off-world."
"How do you intend to do that?"
"Damascus," she said. "Believe me, the Damascus Project is the key. The dream, the doctor, and the message."
"Take my hand," I said. "We're going to find your escape route."
In the distance, but closer than before, another electronic ripple, the sound of pursuit. And Lilla put her hand in mine and we ran, the two of us, for our lives. In the end, I'm not even sure how we found the tree. Just the right one at just the right time in a place that was full of them. It was the fourth from the gates to the park, pretty much where the doctor had said it would be, but I can't pretend that I found it so logically as that. It was instinct which led me there, and intuition. We reached the tree and we knocked together on the bark as the sounds of the milieu crackled ever closer. We were both out of breath from the run, both energised as adrenaline coursed through us, and we both trusted in the dream. We were right in our conviction because at the very moment that we'd knocked four times, the grass beneath us gave a sudden lurch as if it was subject to some weirdly localised earthquake. A chunk of earth, no bigger than an arm's length, started to descend smoothly into the ground. We had to hold on to one another in order to keep our balance on what, it soon became clear, was some kind of disguised elevator. We clung to each other, and we descended, down into the unknown, down into the world beyond the trees. We weren't long in the darkness. Light was waiting for us, and what looked like a concrete bunker. It had a sort of terrifying blandness, and it seemed to me to sport all the worst features of this time and place. Its fearfulness and power. paranoia, its secrecies and anxieties. The place was empty, but there was a floor and a corridor beyond. "This is Damascus," I asked. "Well, it's got to be here somewhere," Lilla said. "It's been waiting for me." "Your father?" I thought back to the vision she had shown me, to the laboratory and his inventions. "He made it," Lilla said. "A transportation machine. Keyed it only to me, as a way for me to get away if circumstances ever became impossible. Pity I was like this planet." "You'll be fine," I said. "There's a whole universe out there." She grinned. "I know. But come on. Let's find what my dad made." It was her turn now to take my hand as we stepped swiftly out of the room. Outside was a desk and a corridor and a half a dozen soldiers, all wearing an insignia I didn't recognise and all, mercifully for our purposes, asleep. We went quickly past these glazed and dozing guards to the end of the corridor and a green steel door. Two more guards were outside, both slumped wearily at their posts. Between them stood a telephone on a dark grey plinth. At our approach, it began to ring, a horrible mechanical grinding sound. "Do you know what?" Lilla asked as we drew closer. "I think I ought to answer that." There wasn't time for me to say anything before Lilla had picked up the receiver and was saying, "Hello, who is this?" There was a long pause before she said, "Yes, I thought it might be you, or someone like you. At any rate, another old man in an expensive suit." Her interlocutor must have reacted to that, as there was a gap before she said, "Well, your guards are all asleep, and what you call the Damascus Project was never yours in the first place." Another, shorter gap before, "Lilla, Prime Minister. My name's Lilla. And I just hope this teaches you something important about taking what doesn't belong to you." She grinned at me again and placed the receiver back in the cradle. "Who you were talking to," I said. "Was that..." Lilla shrugged. "You've got to speak truth to power, don't you think? At least once in a while. That's what my dad used to say anyway." I found, unexpectedly, that I was grinning. "Mine too." There wasn't time for more. She seized both my hands. "What's beyond that door? It'd damage you. My father made sure that it was only for me. I expect they've lost a few poor souls already trying to make it work for them. I'd hate to put you in the firing line too. It'll be bad enough once I go. As soon as I leave, the field will be lifted. So we'll say goodbye out here." "Goodbye and thank you, Livchenka, for everything." "No," I said. "Thank you." "I can't think for what. All I've done is put you in unnecessary danger." "No," I said. "Thank you for the perspective." The girl grinned again. "You're very welcome. I hope we'll meet again someday. Perhaps," she gestured vaguely, "out there." "Your dad," I said suddenly, blurting this out without quite knowing why. "I saw him when you showed me your life."
"Did you?
I mean, before he left you. Did you ever get the chance to say goodbye?" Lilla shook her head in a small, tight motion.
"No, not really. At least, not so that he could understand."
She looked at me with a greater degree of wisdom in her eyes than ought to have been the case.
"And you? Did you ever get that opportunity?"
"No," I said. "I did not."
"But you travel in time, don't you? So, who knows? Perhaps one day you will."
She smiled, leaned forward and kissed me lightly on the cheek.
"Bye-bye, Livchenka,"
she said. And then she turned and opened the green door. There was a flash of very bright white light and instinctively I closed my eyes. When I opened them again, the light had dimmed and Lilla was gone. I stepped into the room and, feeling no real surprise at all, but just a sort of hollowness, I saw that it was completely empty. Bare walls and concrete and the sense faint but tantalizing, that something magical had gone for good. I had to move more quickly after that. As Lilla had promised, the listlessness field was lifted at once, and all around me people had started waking up and returning to their old selves again. I suppose I had too, in a way. I hurried past the soldiers, still sluggish, boarded the grass elevator and returned to the surface. It was almost dark when I got there, and I wondered how long I'd been gone. Since then, I've theorised that the Damascus Project possessed something which warped time very slightly, that frayed its edges, worried away at the corners of it. I think I'm right. As soon as I was back beside the tree, I heard a sort of high-pitched chittering sound, and then the injunction, "Turn around." I turned to face the speaker, and I can't say I was exactly shocked to see that it was alien. He was short and stocky, almost half my height, with a whiskery pelt partly covered by silvery armour. He had something of the vole about him, and there was evident malice in his black and pupilless eyes. Before him, he held out a squat metallic object, which was obviously a weapon. He said in his shrill, warbling voice,
"You will give me the location of the girl from Augustine's Mercy, or I will hurt you badly, without compunction or remorse."
I faced down far worse than him, so at this weak threat, I only arched an eyebrow and said, "You're from the milieu, aren't you?" He looked surprised at this, that I should have known the name of his species, but nodded once. "Well, you're too late," I said. His mouth opened as if he was about to speak, but before he could do so, he seemed to shimmer, fade, and disappear, the effect accompanied by the same electric rumble that we'd heard before. And so I was left alone in the park again as twilight fell and as all around me, humanity woke up. I walked home slowly, taking my time as gradually the city went back to normal, as people shook off their fatigue and apathy, and the asking of questions began. Back at Baker Street, I told Molly something of the truth, although I didn't trouble her with every detail. Later that evening, as their primitive telecommunications network was restored, we listened with quiet amusement at the cover story that was provided by the authorities. At the Prime Minister, speaking inexplicably from the rural city of Norwich, reassuring the nation. And after that day was ended, I dreamed of the doctor again. He did not speak this time, but only smiled. He was back in his garden. The birds were all gone now, and the sky was clear. I woke just before dawn, filled with an odd sense of comfort, but also with a strong desire to speak to you. It never really goes away, does it? The ache of bereavement. I miss you all the time. There are moments when I'm filled up with regret. And yet something Lilla said has stayed with me. Her suggestion, made right at the end, that it might one day finally be possible for me to say goodbye to you. And I don't know why, Dad. I can't be certain. But I've the strangest feeling that somehow, mysteriously, she was right.